Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a Dhamma talk from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey. If you find benefit from this talk, please support the restoration, the preservation, and the presentation of the Buddha's Dhamma with your donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
So, Helen and Russ have joined us. Andrew as well, while we were meditating. I think that's all who joined us. It does look like from my end that some people are having difficulties connecting. I don't know what else to say about that. I know that Zoom wants us to all update our apps by the end of the month. Perhaps we should have done it now, but that notice just went out. So when we're done tonight before the next session, if you want, just update all your Zoom apps on whatever devices you're using. Today's the third class in this particular structured study called Local Knowledge, Uncommon Dhamma. We started with a look at the meaning of becoming, which puts the focus on the immediacy of Dhamma practice, meaning that the Dhamma is to be practiced through a well-concentrated mind, holding the refined mindfulness to be present with life as life occurs. There's no Dhamma possible in the past, obviously, and there's no Dhamma in the future because it doesn't relate to anything that is speculative and outside of human experience. And the only human experience that any human being can ever have is with life as life occurs. We can fabricate all we want about past and future realities, but they do not relate to the Dhamma. And we can debate endlessly on the realities of that, the relative realities of past and future. But even that argument has nothing to do with the Buddha's Dhamma. So last week or last class, we looked at what the Buddha awakened to, dependent origination, which states, from ignorance of Four Noble Truths, all manner of confusion, delusion, and ongoing stress and suffering arises. So it is a lack of understanding of these four noble human truths that is the problem. And that the point of calling them that, noble truths, is just to signify that these four truths are the Dhamma and they relate to the Dhamma. There's many other things that are, excuse me for a minute. That person doesn't want to come in. There's many other things that are true, obviously. I mean, there's an endless list of things that are true. Trees grow out of the ground, you know, dogs bark. Sometimes Zoom works, sometimes it doesn't work. Those are all true, but they're not related to the Dhamma. It doesn't matter how much I believe that trees grow out of the ground and it's true. That's not going to give me any kind of understanding towards who I am in relation to the world around me. It's not going to give me any understanding of the Dhamma. So immediately from that understanding, we realize that this is a very well-focused, I don't think I've ever used these words. This is a very well-focused package that Siddhartha Gautama put together, and it's characterized by today's talk. And this is an interesting talk on Four Noble Truths. It's not the Buddha's first teaching, which is the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the first time he ever taught Four Noble Truths, the first time in human history that Four Noble Truths were I can't think of the right word. Anyway, became part of human history. This is a sutta that was probably given, I know it was given later. There's no real understanding of how much later. But again, in my, just to speculate a little bit, I would bet a year or two into the Buddhist teachings, where Sariputta is now prevalent and an important one of the Buddha's chief disciples. And so the Buddha will start this sutta, but then Sariputta picks it up and explains the Four Noble Truths from his awakened perspective. The Sakavabhanga Sutta. On one occasion, the Buddha was staying at the deer park in Isipatana. He addressed those gathered. Friends, it was here that I set in motion the unexcelled wheel of Dhamma. My Dhamma cannot be corrupted by any Brahman, Deva, Mara, Brahma, or anyone in the entire world. Isn't that an interesting statement, a way to open up this sutta? because the only motivation that an awakened human being would have for that statement is he's noticing, even during the Buddhist time, the corruption of his own Dhamma. And so he starts out with that caution. He notices the adaptations, accommodations, and embellishments already in his Dhamma, and he starts with that caution. And then you'll see that he brings it back to the Four Noble Truths. No one can corrupt the revelation, the declaration, the description, the structure, the explanation, and the clear and direct teaching of Four Noble Truths. One, the noble truth of stress and suffering, the noble truth of the origination of stress, the noble truth of the cessation of stress, and the noble truth of the Eightfold Path of practice that leads to the cessation of stress. Those are the Four Noble Truths. They are very simple. They're also very direct. They're also extremely broad. What I just read is the entire scope and purpose of the Buddha's Dhamma. Obviously, there's much more to developing the Dhamma, but this establishes what Dhamma practice is all about. The Buddha continues, and this is another key part of developing the Dhamma. And I'm going to talk about associations. What is first apparent in associations is are obvious associations with each other, with other physical beings and with physical objects. And then as we start developing the Dhamma, we realize what the Buddha is really talking about as far as associations is what we're associating with within our own minds. And if we're associating as Dhamma practice with an authentic Dhamma, then we will develop the Dhamma. If we continue to associate with fabricated dharmas or simply fabricated philosophies, no matter how many people follow those philosophies, we're not practicing the Dhamma. There may be some benefit to that, but as Dhamma practitioners, we need to be very clear that what we associate with will determine what we become. And if we associate with fabricated dharmas or even partially associate with fabricated dharmas, we can't do what we learned we can do in the first class, become awakened. Because then in this moment, I'm practicing something other than the Buddha's Dhamma. It's just that simple. I'm practicing something that may be a truth, but it's certainly not a noble truth. I hope that's Brett coming in. Give me a second, just let me make sure this is Brett. Come on. That's Brett. How are you, Brett? The Buddha continues, friends, associate with wise disciples, such as Sariputta and Moggallana. Moggallana was the other chief disciple of the Buddha. They both came to the Buddha on the same day. They both learned directly from the Buddha, and within a couple of weeks, they became awakened human beings. Sariputta and Moggallana are well-trained, focused, wise, and sympathetic to those developing a life integrated with the Eightfold Path. Sariputta is like a mother giving birth, and Moggallana is like the nurse that attends to the baby. Isn't that nice? Sariputta trains others on developing the Dhamma, while Moggallana to the highest culmination of the Dhamma. Sariputta is able to declare, teach, describe, set forth, reveal, explain, and make plain Four Noble Truths in detail. He's setting up, he's teaching others how to find a qualified teacher, and he's using Sariputta as an example. The qualification is that you actually know it and you're able to teach it. Having said these words, the Buddha left for the day's abiding. Sariputta then addressed those gathered. Friends, it was here that the Tathagata, meaning the Buddha, set in motion the unexcelled wheel of the Dhamma. This Dhamma cannot be corrupted by any Brahman, Deva, Mara, Brahma, or anyone in the entire world. No one can corrupt the revelation, declaration, the description, the structure, the explanation, and the clear and direct teaching of Four Noble Truths. And he describes those truths again. Friends, what is the noble truth of stress and suffering? Again, notice the obviousness of this. And then I'll talk a little bit more about why it's taken an awakened human being and his disciples to make what is obvious a Dhamma practice. Friends, what is the noble truth of stress and suffering? Birth is stressful. Sickness is stressful. Aging is stressful. Death is stressful. Sorrow, regret, pain, distress, and despair are all stressful. Not getting what is desired is stressful. I want. Receiving what is undesired is stressful. I don't want. In short, the five clinging aggregates are stressful. And we've learned over time that the five clinging aggregates are the Buddha's description of the individual ongoing stress and suffering that's rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. It's simply a description of suffering. And what is birth? Whatever takes birth. We touched on this last week. The descent, the coming to be, the coming forth, the arising of the five clinging aggregates. The fabrication of sensuous realms of diverse beings. This is called birth. So these few lines directly point to Dhamma practice. How do we get so confused about what's the point? Let me read it again. And what is birth? Whatever takes birth, the descent, whatever takes birth in the context of the Dhamma is not me. I'm already here. I don't need to know where I came from as far as my Dhamma practice is concerned. There's a self-referential part of me that insists I must know where I come from. I must know that a God created me because I'm worth being created by a God and not just something else or not just by a mistake of evolution. And I need to know that a God is watching out for me and is going to take care of me forever and ever and ever and ever. That's the most self-referential thought any human being could ever have, is it? And there's no foundation in reality. It may be true. Billions of people believe in just that scenario. But it doesn't make it true, and it is irrelevant to the Buddha's Dhamma. Meaning, even if it is true, what I need to do is to understand who I am in relation to the world I'm living in. I need to know what it means to be a human being, not a higher being. Not a being that can justify its own self-referential views by creating these fabulous scenarios, I'm use the word fantastic scenarios, in order to establish an ordinary human being in an extraordinary manner, which is what most of religion, and now I'll focus on Buddhism, which is what all of modern Buddhism attempts to do, rather than develop understanding of what it means to be a human being. That's what we're talking about here. That's what Four Noble Truths describe. These most profound and liberating teachings are about what it means to be a human being. What more could a human being want than to understand that? And continue. The fabrication of sensuous realms of diverse beings. That's another line to creating speculative non-physical establishments for our fabricated notion of what a self is. If I do enough good things, I can end up in Tulsita Buddhist heaven forever and ever, and I'm good to go. But if I do that, if I spend the rest of my life trying to get to Tulsita heaven or a Christian heaven or any type of non-physical speculative existence, what have I done? I've just wasted my whole life trying to get someplace that I can't get to. Rather than understand and develop a common peaceful mind through that understanding of who and what I am in relation to the world I live in. Sariputta continues, and what is aging? Aging is the increasing decrepitude, the brokenness, the graying, the wrinkling, the decline of the life force, the diminishing of mental faculties of all diverse beings. This is called aging. Again, why does the Buddha need to point, or Sariputta in this case, need to point out something that every single human being goes through? We have to experience all of this, don't we, if we have a human life? Unless we die after a few minutes after birth. Why is that? Why are we talking about something? Why are we spending our time in this life talking about something that is so obvious? Because we don't want to face the obvious. We don't want to accept the fact as a consequence of having a human life, I'm going to get sick at times, maybe chronically, and every single moment of this life, I'm aging, and I'm aging closer towards the end. Life is a death sentence. What is the importance of this? Why is there such an emphasis on this by the Buddha, Sariputta, and now me? Because like Bahia, I want to ignore it. I want to believe that this fabricated self can somehow live on forever and ever and ever and ever and ever. And that's why I so greedily buy into fabricated notions of eternity for myself, meaning that I have a soul. If I can figure out the right way and the right rules and the right manipulations, then I can establish this soul in eternity. Or I can put aside those foolish notions and learn what it means to be a human being. This is what the Buddha taught. Sariputta continues. And what is age? I read that. This is called age. And what is death? Death is the passing away, the breaking up, the disappearance, the completion of time. What an important line there. The completion of time. Think about the ramifications of that one line to I was going to say a world, but the Buddha wasn't talking to the world then, to a large community that almost to a person believed in eternity. And he's using a line like that, the completion of time. He had to set people's heads spinning by just saying that simple line. But he's saying that line out of great compassion to let people know you got one chance to do this. And it's a fleeting chance. Remember Bahia. He was right in pleading with the Buddha for his teaching, because no one can know when the end is here for me or for our teachers. It's now that we take up the Dhamma. Getting back to our first class in this series, it is now that I become awakened, or it is now that I become further ignorant. And that has to do with me and me alone. And it has to do with what I choose to concentrate on and hold in mind. And if I continue to hold in mind that which is rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, I can only become further ignorant in this moment. Or I can develop understanding, as Sariputta is teaching us today, and liberate myself from my own ignorance of these four truths. Continuing. And the casting off of the body, the interruption of the life faculty, and the dissolution of the five clinging aggregates, this is called death. The dissolution of the five clinging aggregates. So the Buddha is also stating there that even the fabricated self that I've created does not continue the physical death. So even the fabricated notion that there's some way to work off my ignorance post my physical life is negated right there with that one line. And that was a common belief too, that this is a continuation of, and it's part of every religion, that salvation is a continuing, what's the right word? I was going to say task, but salvation is a continuing opportunity within that religion. But if you leave the religion, you've lost the opportunity. So how can you leave the religion? And I'll tell you something, I don't think I've ever thought about this. It just kind of popped into my head now. There was a period of time when I was transitioning from my confused, muddled beliefs from a lifetime of living in this world, both as beginning as a Roman Catholic and a Christian, and then for many years studying Buddhist religions. And even after I came to what the Buddha actually taught, there was a period of undoing my own clinging notion in a salvation God and a salvation type of existence. Excuse me. And so what I mean by that is even though I had adopted the Buddhist teachings and was practicing them, I believe as authentically as I possibly could, engaging in a lot of the focus that I talk about here all the time, doing my best to stay focused on what the Buddha taught and eliminate and abandon all the things that I had learned up until that time. And even with that strong intention, I still found myself in times of stress having that magical thought that maybe God will deliver me, or maybe this being that is supposed to be my angel watching out for me is somehow going to manipulate things in this world so that I'm better off in another world. And it's such a pernicious belief that as long as I held onto a shred of that belief, I couldn't make the profound leap into concentration and refined mindfulness, because hanging on to a shred of ignorance clouds everything that mind is holding on to. And I can remember very clearly when I understood that I had to actually deal with this thing. I couldn't make believe that all of this conditioned thinking, a lifetime of conditioned thinking, would simply vanish magically. I was still hoping on, my belief was still the magical belief that most people have in religion, that this God now that I was believing in, Buddha, was going to take away all of my doubts. And it wasn't until I started understanding the Buddha and the nature of my own thinking that I realized that even that was a cruel and pernicious thought. That it wasn't something that would happen to me. I developed these ideas and these ideologies, and it was up to me to recognize and abandon them. And what is sorrow? Sorrow is sadness, the suffering of misfortune, being touched by pain. This is called sorrow. And what is regret? Regret is the grieving, the crying, the weeping, the wailing, the regret of suffering, suffering from misfortune, of being touched by pain. This is called regret. And what is pain? Pain is bodily pain, bodily discomfort, pain or discomfort from bodily contact. This is called pain. And what is distress? Distress is mental pain and mental discomfort, pain or discomfort from mental contact. This is called distress. And what is despair? Despair is despondency and desperation of anyone suffering from misfortune or touched by a painful thing. This is called despair. And what is the stress of not getting what is desired? In those being subject to birth, the wish arises, may I not be subject to birth? May birth not come to me? Wishing does not bring cessation. This is the stress of not getting what is desired. And so there it is again, the wanting things to be different than they are, wanting me to be different than I am, including continuing fabricated views, which were rooted in that motivation to be something other than I am, is the essence of dukkha. It's the essence of ignorance. Furthermore, in uninformed human beings, those subject to birth, sickness, aging, and death, sorrow, regret, pain, distress, and despair, the wish arises, oh, may I not be subject to birth, sickness, aging, and death, sorrow, regret, pain, distress, and despair. May these not befall me. These things are not avoided by wishing. This is the truth of stress and of not getting what is desired. So wishing, again, Sariputta is just telling those in front of him and all of us now, we can wish all we want. We can have as much desire that these things don't happen to us, but if our minds are still rooted in ignorance, there's nothing we can do about it. We're going to continue to give birth to other moments rooted in ignorance, moments that have the potential for confusion, delusion, and ongoing stress and suffering. And what are the five clinging aggregates? Clinging to the form aggregate, clinging to the feeling aggregate, clinging to the perception aggregate, and clinging to the fabrication aggregate, and clinging to the consciousness aggregate. So these five things that make up every human being, form, feelings, perceptions, mental fabrications, and consciousness, meaning ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, is maintained by clinging to these five things, these five aggregates. Remember independent origination from last week, that from contact comes clinging and maintaining, from clinging and maintaining comes becoming. This is the jumping off point of the Dhamma. It is at that point of contact that is giving rise to a reaction or a mindful response that the Dhamma is practiced. Again, what am I going to become in this moment? These are the five clinging aggregates that constitutes stress. This, friends, is the noble truth of stress. And what is the noble truth of the origination of stress? The very craving that makes for becoming further ignorant. Craving, clinging to passion and delight after what is crazed, delight after what is crazed, including adapted, accommodated, and or embellished modern dharmas, my words. The Sariputta continues, entranced here and there, with craving for sensuality, entranced, mesmerized, hypnotized by our own desire, craving for continued becoming. No matter how much stress there is in this moment, a mind rooted in ignorance will crave for things that will only continue that stress, even if the mind believes that it's a release. A good example would be addiction or compulsive behaviors of any kind, because in the moment that mind is looking for release, even though the release will almost always guarantee more stress and suffering. It doesn't matter because the mind is rooted in ignorance. It can't see that clearly. And I can tell you that I experienced that to such a severe level that I almost killed myself, literally, physically, twice from that level of ignorance. Craving for non-becoming. This is called the noble truth of the origination of stress. And what, friends, is a noble truth of the cessation of stress? The renunciation, the relinquishment, the release, the letting go, the remainderless fading away and complete cessation of craving. I'll read that again. The Buddha's describing awakening. The noble truth of the cessation of stress. It's the renunciation, the relinquishment, the release, the letting go, the remainderless fading away, meaning there's not a shred of ignorance left to provoke another moment of ignorance, and complete cessation of craving. This is called the noble truth of the cessation of stress. There's nothing ambiguous about that, is there? We know the goal of the path is just that. And what is the noble truth of the path of Dhamma practice that leads directly to the cessation of stress? This path is a noble eightfold path. Right view. Right view is knowledge with regard to stress, knowledge with regards to the origination of stress, knowledge with regards to the cessation of stress, and knowledge with regards to the eightfold path of practice leading to the cessation of stress. I know if each of you looked at your developing right view, you would see that it's developing along those exact same lines. You are developing the knowledge with regards to stress, knowledge with regards to the origination of stress, knowledge with regards to the cessation of stress, and you're all developing knowledge with regards to the path leading to the cessation of stress. In other words, you are engaged in a practice of developing right view. And there's no ambiguity here either, is there? When I first started reading these things and read how clear and direct the Buddha's teachings were, and then thought about how confused and convoluted and contradictory most of the teachings I was being fed, there was more than just a little bit of self-referential upset with that until I realized that that was my responsibility. It wasn't anybody else's responsibility. It's up to me what I learn and what I take in, isn't it? Sorry, I just need two. Right intention. Right intention is maintaining mindfulness of the intention for renunciation, for freedom from ill will, for harmlessness, for cessation. This is right intention. Right intention basically is maintaining the intention to recognize and abandon craving for and clinging to fabricated views, views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. Number three, right speech. Right speech is abstaining from lying, abstaining from divisive speech. Boy, that's a good one today. Abstaining from abusive speech and abstaining from gossip and idle chatter. I was going to say something about the current state of affairs, but I'll let it go. This is right speech. Right action. Right action is abstaining from taking life, abstaining from stealing, abstaining from sexual misconduct. This is right action. Right livelihood. Right livelihood is when a skillful disciple of the noble ones has abandoned dishonest livelihood and provides for themselves with honesty. This is right livelihood. Right effort. Right effort is when a skillful disciple of the noble ones internally generates the skillful desire, who is persistent, who remains mindful of their intent for the non-arising of unskillful qualities that have yet arisen, who remains mindful of their intent for the abandoning of unskillful qualities that have arisen, who remains mindful for maintaining non-confusion and for increasing developing and the culmination of skillful qualities that have yet arisen. This is right effort. It's just right effort means right effort that is actually engaged in authentic Dhamma practice. Number seven, right mindfulness. Right mindfulness is when a skillful disciple of the noble ones remains mindful of the body in and of itself. Excuse me. Who remains mindful of the body in and of itself refers to the line in and of itself refers to remaining mindful of the body in and of itself without any embellishment, without any self-referential views, without any ignorant views attached to it, simply seeing a human being as it is, in and of itself. So every human being, in and of itself, is made up of four elements, a space property, and a consciousness property. That's it. A human being can't be any more. They can make more out of their life. They can have an endless list of experiences. They can acquire all types of things and titles and positions. But you can never change, a human being can never change the basic fact of what it is. It cannot embellish itself. Let me go back to it. Remain mindful of the body in and of itself while remaining ardent, alert, and mindful of putting aside greed and distress with reference to the world. That last line, ardent, alert, and mindful while putting aside greed and distress with reference to the world, is a reference to right mindfulness. It's holding in mind what is important to the Dhamma, not the typical applications of mindfulness, which is really a direction towards mindlessness. Because it directs the mind away from holding in mind the principles of the Eightfold Path. That's the Buddha's application of mindfulness, by the way. Holding in mind the principles of the Eightfold Path. Right mindfulness is when a skillful disciple of the Noble Ones remains mindful of feelings in and of themselves while remaining ardent, alert, and mindful while putting aside greed and distress with reference to the world. Right mindfulness is when a skillful disciple of the Noble Ones remains mindful of thoughts in and of themselves while remaining ardent, alert, and mindful, while putting aside greed and distress with reference to the world. Right mindfulness is when a skillful disciple of the Noble Ones remains mindful of the present quality of mind in and of itself, while remaining ardent, alert, and mindful of putting aside greed and distress with reference to the world. This is right mindfulness. What is that last exposition of mindfulness referred directly to? Who knows? Anybody want to say? No? The Buddha's referring, or Sariputta's referring directly to the four foundations of mindfulness, isn't he? As they relate to the Four Noble Truths. 8, right meditation. Right meditation is when a skillful disciple of the Noble Ones has established seclusion from sensuality and unskillful mental qualities. They enter and remain in the first jhana. This first jhana is experienced as rapture born of that very seclusion. It is accompanied by directed thought and evaluation. We're going to do some classes on jhana, so I won't get too deep into it. But just to point out, this is what each and every one of you experience when you first take a breath and begin your meditation practice. You experience, and you might not even notice it as a profound experience of joy, but just the acknowledgement that I'm now sitting in meditation again brings a certain calm and peace. That's what the Buddha's referring to. It's the rapture born of that very... So rapture is kind of an ancient and archaic word that often has biblical associations. What rapture means in this instance is simply a focused, joyful engagement with what we're doing. I mean, a joyful engagement with the Buddha's authentic Dhamma. And that first jhana is accompanied by directed thought and evaluation. So that simply means it's directed thought. It means that I find myself caught up in my thoughts. I direct my thought back to my thinking. And even in that first level of jhana, and I'm sure all of you have experienced it, you're judging or evaluating your meditation, whether it's good, bad, successful, etc., whether it fits within the guidelines you've been taught, whether you're actually coming back to your breath fast enough, or whether it's taking... All of that is part of evaluation. It's a normal part of the first jhana. So when you find yourself doing that, don't think you're doing something wrong. It's just the beginning part of jhana practice. Furthermore, the ending of defilements depends on the second jhana, which is the stilling of directed thought and evaluation. This second jhana is experienced as rapture and pleasure born of concentration. So there's a subtle difference between the first and second level of jhana that might not be so obvious. The first is recognizing and taking joy or rapture in that very seclusion while continuing to direct my thought back towards my breath when I find that I'm distracted. As I deepen my concentration, I can recognize that fact that my concentration is deepening. It's important to recognize that. That's the reason why the Buddha taught jhanas, is not to create a hierarchy within our own meditation practice, but simply as benchmarks or guideposts for our own meditation practice. So we notice ever-deepening concentration in its most effective way. Yes, I notice my mind is more concentrated. I'm not nearly as distracted as I was a week ago, a month ago, a year ago, because now I can sit and I can take two breaths before I get caught up in my thoughts rather than just one. That's progress, and it's real progress. It needs to be noticed. Free of directed thought and evaluation, the joy of concentration permeates their entire mind and body. And I would bet every one of you have had an experience of that joy permeating your entire body. It may not have lasted very long for most of you, but you've had it. In fact, I would say I'm sure you've all had it. And then you come back to a mind that is distracted and you lose it. And then you take another breath and you come back to it. And every time you do that and deepen your level of jhana, deepen your level of meditative absorption, you're increasing the concentration that you're able to take off your cushion and into your moment-by-moment life. It increases your opportunity in the moment to practice the Dhamma. I'm going to skip over a little bit of commentary. Sariputta continues, furthermore, the ending of the defilements, I didn't mention earlier, you all know the defilements are greed, aversion, and deluded thinking that arise from ignorance of Four Noble Truths. The ending of the defilements depends on the third jhana, which is the fading of rapture. The fading of rapture doesn't mean that I'm no longer joyful and I've lost that joyful rapture. It simply means my concentration is now to the point where it's not noticed. They remain equanimous, mindful, alert, sensitive to pleasure. Sensitive to pleasure. It's an important line. It doesn't mean when I'm sensitive to pleasure, it doesn't mean that I'm grasping after sensual pleasure. It simply means that I'm sensitive. I'm able to notice it. I'm able to acknowledge it, but not be distracted. That's a significant difference between grasping after and simply being sensitive to something. That's the proper use of the sixth sense base. And sensitive to pleasure. With the fading of rapture, this pleasant abiding permeates the entire mind and body. With the fading of rapture, this pleasant abiding. So even that initial joy that we feel about Dhamma practice, we're finding here is fabricated, isn't it? Of course it is. It's still rooted in that mind that is itself rooted in ignorance. But it points out such an important and brilliant aspect of the Buddha's Dhamma. It meets us right where we are. No matter how ignorant we are, the Buddha's Dhamma can interrupt that ignorance and develop wisdom in that same mind. If that was impossible, if that wasn't an integral part of the Dhamma, there'd be no opportunity to awaken, would there be? But of course there is. It's simply by practicing the Dhamma right where we began a few weeks ago, at the point of becoming. Sariputta continues, furthermore, the ending of the defilements depends on the fourth jhana, which is the abandoning of evaluation. They enter remain in the fourth jhana, which is pure equanimity and mindful. Being pure, neither pleasure nor pain is seen. They sit permeated in mind and body with pure, bright awareness. The fourth jhana, which is a pleasant abiding. This is right meditation. They sit permeated in mind and body with pure, bright awareness. Again, I would say that I think every one of you has had that experience. And again, it might not have been for an hour or even for 2 minutes, but you've had that experience. And it's important, again, to recognize that. That's a level of the fourth jhana. What is also being previewed here is the quality of an awakened mind. Sitting permeated in a mind and body with pure, bright awareness. That's a description of an awakened human being, isn't it? And it's a pure, bright awareness that cannot be shaken. It cannot be challenged by anything in the world or anyone in the world or any event in the world. Why? Because it's a pure, bright awareness that's resting in reality. And nothing can affect reality, can it? Once you know it. Once you know who you are in relation to the world, excuse me. Once we know who we are in relation to the world, it's unshakable. It's like knowing your own name. And someone comes up and tells me now that, you know, your name is Frankie. I know it's not. And I know for sure that it's not, because I know who I am. The same way I now know who and what I am in relation to the world. And it's because of the Buddha's Dhamma. It's because of what Sariputta and the Buddha are talking about here. Because I did these things. Because we're doing these things. I've had the same experiences now that the Buddha and Sariputta was describing 2,600 years ago to other wise Dhamma practitioners who were able to then, ehepasiko, verify it for themselves. In fact, you could say, in a sense, that the reason why the Buddha teaches the Dhamma is for the sole reason that we can verify it for ourselves. We practice the Dhamma for the sole reason that we can verify it for ourselves. And if we can't, we either have a little bit more to go or we're not practicing the Dhamma. Because the Buddha's Dhamma is entirely verifiable. That's where he starts with. That's what we started that 2 weeks ago too, with the meaning of becoming. In this moment is where the Dhamma is practiced. In this moment is where we verify the effectiveness of the Buddha's Dhamma. Sariputta continues. This is the noble truth of the Eightfold Path of Practice that leads directly to the cessation of stress and suffering. Friends, it was here that the Tathagata, meaning the Buddha, set in motion the unexcelled wheel of Dhamma. This Dhamma cannot be corrupted by any Brahman, any Deva, Mara, Brahma, or anyone in the entire world. No one can corrupt the revelation, the declaration, the description, the structure, the exclamation, and the clear and direct teaching of Four Noble Truths. This is what Venerable Sariputta said. Those that were there were delighted. It's the end of the sutta. Ah, what a sutta, huh? let's just go around the room, and I'd like to hear what you all have to say. And I'm going to start up at the top with Ram. Ram, how are you?
I'm good. Yeah, this was the Dhamma and Cliff Notes. The whole thing. I was a little struck by your little piece you said about looking or clinging to salvation, and I realized that, you know, I, also being a lab Catholic, I realized that I left that part of clinging to salvation pretty early on. But later on, looking at my emotional state, I realized that I was actually looking for salvation more in other people, like in relationships.
Yep.
And you know, and even things, jobs, just to save me from basically the stress of life's uncertainties. It took a long time to get rid of that. It's like an underlying theme in my life that something else, somewhere else, is going to take away this stress of basically life's uncertainty.
Yeah,
that's the stressful part of it. But practicing the Dhamma finally ends that, because you do keep getting thrown back on yourself. This is not somebody else. This is not something else that is going to take that stress away. You are going to take it away. That's it. Final.
That's brilliant, Ram. I mean, you described the internal mental process that's rooted in ignorance that leads to speculative views. That's it's just that way, isn't it? And you really did just you described it beautifully. But when we see that, you know, it's like this. It's like the fourth jewel of the triple refuge. This is the fourth jewel, is understanding that this thing called ignorance is really the problem. And look at what it does for us, or does to us. Mm-hmm. And it becomes very obvious, doesn't it? When you can see it that way. Of course, I fabricate things because I'm fabricating out of a mind that doesn't know what it's doing. It doesn't know what's occurring here. Thank you. Yeah. Lorna, how are you? Good to see you.
Hello, John. I'll sit in noble silence tonight, please.
I'm glad you joined us. Jane, how are you?
I'm fine, John. What's compelling to me is the fact that I basically am the one who controls what's going to happen moment to moment. It's what I'm holding in mind that will decide whether it's, you know, a peaceful moment or a stressful moment. I don't have to depend on someone else.
Yep.
That it's me.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's no matter what's occurring, it's always me, isn't it?
Right.
It's up to me how I feel and how I think. It's so freeing. There's so much power in that one thought, one true thought. Thank you, Jane. Tom, how are you tonight?
Good morning, John.
Hello, and, Tom.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Great. I concur with. I've definitely, especially what Ram was saying at the beginning. That's something I've really resonates with me. I think what I've really gained from or learned from joining this sangha, which I'm really grateful for, is the directness of the teachings and demystifying for me some of the more the mystical sides of Buddhism, and realizing what a random kind of mixed match of teachings I've sort of taken on board over the last sort of 10 years or so that I've more or less been interested in meditation and Buddhism. Now, I just, on that theme, I just had one question, because you've sort of inspired me to retrain my focus a bit more on the teachings and where they're coming from. Apologies if you already may have mentioned this a bit at the beginning, but I didn't really take it on board so well. But the name is Sariputta, is that right?
Yep.
I was just hoping if you could just quickly share a bit more about him. I believe it's a man, and his relationship to the Buddha, and why we should take Sariputta in particular and the teachings from Sariputta, I don't know quite the right word, but so seriously, let's say, as opposed to other teachings that might be out there.
Thank you, Tom. It was such a great question. Sariputta and Moggallana were both contemporaries of the Buddha. It's not likely they knew each other prior to when they came together, which was just after the Buddha's awakening. But they had to have studied the same teachers that were all part of northern India and southern Nepal at the time. So they had the same experiences. There's some articles on the website about Sariputta and Moggallana, by the way, that also teach this. But they finally, the Buddha awakened, and I won't tell the whole story, and a few weeks later, Sariputta and Moggallana kind of showed up, not on the Buddha's doorstep, but at the Buddha's Sangha. And they took teachings from the Buddha within a couple of weeks. I mean, it's quite a dramatic story there. Within a few weeks, they both had awakened, gained full human maturity, and immediately began being teachers within the original Sangha. And so they would be the chief disciples of the Buddha for his entire teaching career. As the Buddha's Dhamma developed the Dhamma, many of them went out and then taught. It wasn't just Sariputta and Moggallana who taught. Most of the, I'm using a word, it's not, many of the original Sangha members learned the Dhamma well enough that the Buddha then said, all right, go out and start teaching. You know, and when you think about it, it's only a hierarchical religion based in mysticism that would try to create something fabricated within it. In other words, well, you have some advanced knowledge because I can see it in your eyes or I can see it in your ears or something, so I'll let you teach. The proof for the Buddha was you actually knew the Dhamma and then you went out and taught. So they were very, very important members of the Buddhist Sangha throughout the Buddha's life. It's a good question. Yeah, I think you finished by saying, why should we listen to them as opposed to other teachers? Well, I guess the answer to that is they actually learned from the Buddha. And so they practiced the Buddha's Dhamma, and so they taught the Buddha's Dhamma, nothing else. Yeah. Good, really good point. I just was writing something out about that today that I'll probably publish in a week or two about just that subject, about the motivation for teachers to take great license with what the Buddha taught, more because they'd rather have more people following them than actually teaching an authentic Dhamma, and that's unfortunate, you know. That's what's happened. Glad you joined us, Tom. Who's there? Helen, how are you? Helen and Russ are here.
Hi, John. Hello, everyone. Nice to be together as much as we can be.
It is.
John, I'm thinking about back when I first joined the Sangha, and we talked about how what the Buddha taught was basically how to live a good life. And truly it is. And I am so aware when I slip. because, you know, I know what I should say or do or how I should best lead my life. But we didn't talk about it. We talked about how it wasn't a religion, and it seems we talk a lot more about that part of it. Like, that's always a part of what we talk about, is why other religions are wrong or why other beliefs are wrong. And I guess for me, the most important part is really how can I lead a good life? Without being judgmental about how other people feel their path takes them to accomplish that too. So I guess that's something I'm feeling tonight.
Thank you, Helen. The reference to other religion is important in the context, because it's so easy to think of this as religion. And as soon as anything has a religious connotation, it also has a fabricated or a speculative connotation. So that's why it's important for me to point it out. And I think the reason why the Buddha felt like it was important to make that distinction rather constantly, you know, because it really does get to the heart of what we're doing here. We're not trying to create anything out of belief. We're trying to have a way of having a direct experience of something. So glad you joined us. Russ, how are you?
Good. Thank you, John. I'm glad to be here. I appreciated the teaching, and I'm going to take noble silence.
Glad you joined us. Tim, how are you?
Well, sir.
How are you?
Very well, thank you. You know, this sort of always kind of, I don't know, it's not, it kind of goes all over the place for me. It touches pretty much on everything. Not just the Four Noble Truths, but the jhana meditation and the five clinging aggregates and karma, not karma so much, but it covers a lot of topics, and we all know that they all intertwine. So, and maybe it's because of my conditioned thinking and how I have gone through life, I've never, you know, bought into any religion to begin with, before coming to meditation, or specifically this Dhamma. And so I've never felt the importance to stress it, but I don't want to minimize it, because other people may find that hard to grasp. So I am empathetic to that. But for me, it's said a lot. You say it a lot, and it's especially in the commentary. And I feel like nothing you ever talk about or what is in the Dhamma that we read is salvific at all. And I never felt that way. So I just wanted to put that out there. With that being said, you know, with regards to the Four Noble Truths, you know, without the refined right view of impermanence, anatta, and dukkha, one will continue to suffer. So without that right view of what the three marks of existence are, we really can't move forward. You know, we can understand. Understanding is easy, John. Understanding is easy to understand these words and go, uh-huh. But the application is only done through that right effort and practice on the Eightfold Path and starting at that right view, because it'll always come around with the five clinging aggregates by not understanding those three marks of existence. Again, it's introspective. I'm not speaking for everybody, especially for me. However, I will say about the sutta that I do appreciate the description of dukkha. It's incredibly intense and profound of any sutta I've read thus far. And I do appreciate that, because imagine how intense it would have been for people to hear that. It is for people to hear it, I would imagine, coming to a Dhamma class for the first, second, or third time, to hear what dukkha is right in front of you. And again, if you can't understand impermanence, which is what that's describing, it'll just scare you.
Yeah.
So that's where my thoughts are kind of going right now with this class. So that's really all I have to say. So hopefully that made some sense.
You did. Thank you, Tim. Is that Kevin right there? Kevin, how are you tonight?
Doing well, John. Thank you very much for the teaching. I appreciate it in the structure of the larger study. And that's all I have today. Double silence. Thank you.
Glad you joined us. How are you, Deborah? Wait a minute, Deborah. Deborah, can you unmute your mic? I can't seem to do it on my end.
Is that good?
There you go. How are you?
I was going up to my picture and trying to unmute it, but you have to do it from the bottom. That was a lot. And, you know, familiar with the Eightfold Path as far as, you know, looked at it a few times and understand the different rites that need to be worked on. And I know a lot about suffering, And I feel like I'm, you know how you're the person that comes into our meditation and says, bring your thoughts back. You know, you tell us to let go of the thoughts and then come back to your breath. Mm-hmm. And I find that probably for about the past 6 months, I have been doing that to myself just in my day.
Uh-huh.
So I will I've really been so, because I'm so immersed in this program, and I've got to have this manual, this year-long manual to hand it in on Friday. And I've been nothing but by a computer for the last 3 days. I truly could not do it with calmness and with any kind of focus if I wasn't doing that. And if I wasn't continually bringing myself back to the moment. The minute I feel I'm getting stressed, I remind myself it's a fabricated story from way back when, it doesn't exist. But I find myself, I'm talking to myself a lot. And I don't know if that's going to pay off at some point, that I'm actually pace and the, you know, the looking at the blades of grass, whatever it might be. But I find that for me to stay in the moment, I have this thought that it just needs to be practiced. So yeah. because I need to not suffer so much, I'm actually doing a right effort when it comes to practicing.
Oh yeah.
And because when I don't, I mean, and my suffering these last 3 days has gone like a ping pong game. So I can be really, really deep in it and the suffering. And then I just can, so I've got a lot of bad habits that pull me into that. So, or I'm just a beginner or whatever it is. I'm just in here now tonight, very, very tired, trying, you know, it was hard for me to absorb, but I am witnessing myself as I move into, as I feel suffering, it hits my body gets tight and tense. Mm-hmm. And then when I come back and just take a moment to breathe, the 2 minutes, 3 minutes and breathe, I feel everything let go. I feel peace, but it's fleeting. You know, if it lasts 5 minutes at a time, it's a win. But still so much, as everyone's talked about, the words, the language, I'm not really that familiar with all of it. So I just like to spend some more time with it.
Yeah. Thank you, Deborah. I'm glad you joined us tonight. And you will. It is just like that. You know, the more you hear it, the more it makes sense, the more you see how the pieces of the puzzle fit together. And again, that's just continuing with the practice. From what you're describing, you're practicing it as it is intended to be practiced, and you'll continue to develop the benefits of it. It's just a matter of hanging in there, you know, and keep doing what you're doing. So I'm glad you joined us tonight. Josh, how are you?
Thank you.
Hello, Josh.
Hi, John. Hi, everybody. Well, as usual, my mind is spinning, and I enjoyed the teaching, and I'm kind of fumbling along this with Tim. First of all, when I meditate, there are been a few times when all of a sudden 20 minutes go by just like flash. And other times they just seem like a struggle. Yeah. and often though I after I finish, I kind of feel like I've had a nap, you know, I feel a little bit energized and feel good. And I just say that because I wonder if everybody kind of experiences that. But the other thing that you mentioned when you talk about what the Buddha said about death is the end of time. Now, is it the end of time whether you're awakened or not awakened?
The time of your... good question. I don't think it matters as far as the Dhamma is concerned. Anything else is pure speculation.
So
what the Dhamma is teaching us is you have one life. You know, now is the time to wake up. Not in the future, not in another life. Now is the time to do it. Pardon me?
Okay. I get it. And I really appreciate that because I really enjoyed the teaching tonight that said that we are responsible for ourselves becoming fully human.
Yep.
And how the Buddha figured this out is beyond me. He understood somehow or other the fundamental truth that there's impermanence. There's kind of a fundamental truth that suffering is a kind of a human condition. understanding these fundamental truths, realizing that human beings were kind of stuck in that, and he found a way that would keep them from becoming fully human, and he figured out a way to kind of have us work on getting around that and following his path.
But, yeah.
God dang, I wish there were an easier way.
Well,
but I don't think there is.
Thank you, Josh. We're fortunate that there is a way. I'm astonished that an individual human being was able to figure this out on his own too. I mean, it's when you read the Nagara Sutta, it's remarkable how he was able to be caught up in fabrications like every other human being, but had such a focus to ultimately put all those fabrications aside and simply see what was obvious about human life, because that's all that he's describing. It's everything the Buddha teaches is right here in front of us, but we can't see it because of a mind rooted in ignorance fabricates what's happening in front of us. And that's the only difference. You know, it's just, there's a term called the veil of ignorance. And this really is a veil of ignorance that's keeping us from living a human life. That's it. And as the Buddha teaches, it's like foam on the ocean. So all the other concerns that we tend to generate about ourselves and our Dhamma practice and the things we need and all this and that, and it should be this and it should be that, it's all nonsense. Because what we're left with is Dhamma practice. And we can either practice the Dhamma or not. And that's up to each individual. A Buddha can't tell us to do it. John Haspel can't tell us to do it. Our friends can't tell us to do it. Only we as individual Dhamma practitioners can decide to practice the Dhamma and develop the Dhamma. It's just that way. So you bring up such great points, Josh. Thank you. Trevor, how are you tonight? Hello, Trevor.
Good to see you. Can you hear me?
I can. Good to see you too.
Great to see everyone. Thanks for the teaching. And I think I'm with what other people said. Head spinning, a lot going on here. A lot to pack into. I would say what's coming up for me is just a question in the context of dependent origination. I'm just wondering, you know, you were interpreting tonight birth, aging, death, sounded like in a very literal way, and saying, you know, this is remarkable that it took an enlightened person to see and say birth, death are stressful, are suffering. I'm wondering too, I mean, some of the language makes it sound more metaphorical, and we're also understanding it as metaphorical and dependent origination. So for instance, when they say birth is making fabrications, birth is five clinging aggregates, those sound like psychological maneuvers, not physical. Mm. So I was just kind of curious how you interpret this. Should we just look at it as mini leveled, you know, definitely a literal interpretation, also a metaphorical linking into dependent origination, or are you understanding that?
Well, it's such an important question, Trevor. Thank you. There's nothing metaphorical about this sutta or dependent origination, but in the context, it has to be understood within the context. In other words, the Buddha wasn't concerned about physical birth or physical death in relation to what causes a physical birth or what happens after a physical death. His only concern is what happens here in life. And so in the context of the Dhamma, in the context of dependent origination, it's what am I giving birth to in this moment? And again, we can get caught up in the semantics, maybe use a different word. What am I giving rise to in this moment? But that really relates, using the word birth tends to relate better to the misunderstandings that religions put on birth and rebirth and death, et cetera, et cetera. So the Buddha's literally talking about what am I giving birth to in this moment? And in the context, in this moment, if I'm continuing ignorance, I'm giving birth to another moment that is characterized by five clinging aggregates. It's literally, it can literally be said that I'm giving birth to five clinging aggregates in this moment. because that's what it is. I'm the one that's responsible for my experience of this moment, aren't I? And so I'm responsible for giving birth to whatever's occurring. And sometimes it's rather obvious, but sometimes, most of the time, it's rather subtle what I'm giving birth to. So I need a well-concentrated mind and refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path to understand if what's arising in this moment is skillful or unskillful. Is it related to awakening, or is it related to ignorance? So does that answer your question? Mm-hmm. That's what's important to give. The Buddha very rarely talked about birth and physical rebirth. It's not to say he never did, but he did it so infrequently to show that it really doesn't matter. And when he did talk about giving birth, it was always in this context of what am I giving birth to in this moment.
Yeah, that's where I was kind of getting a little confused on what you're saying tonight. So that's exactly what would make sense to me, how you just described it. When he says in the Four Noble Truths, birth is stressful, birth is suffering, he's saying when we give birth to not self in this moment, even that birthing process is part of suffering that's stressful.
Yeah, and in that moment, the birthing process is rooted in thoughts. You know, it's a different thing than physical birth that we're talking about, but it's still giving birth, isn't it? In that context, and again, the Buddha used the word karma, but he used it in a completely different way than other people did during his time. It doesn't mean that he shouldn't have used it or that he used it incorrectly. The same with the use of the word birth. I should look up what the Prakrit word is, but he just used the term or the word or the inference in a completely different way. What am I giving birth to in this moment? Because that's what people think. That's how human beings think. You know, so it's important to understand that. We tend to fall into what our conditioned views are of birth, you know, which is physical birth. But that's not what the Buddha is concerned about. An important question, Trevor. Thank you. Michael.
Hi, John. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. I'm just going to bring up one or two things from the sutta. Hopefully, I'll stay on the path here tonight. I'll try to anyhow. what I liked, I think it was on a second page where it says, holding in mind a framework and guidance of the Eightfold Path will give birth to a present moment experience that continues the non-distracted development of wisdom of Four Noble Truths. A present moment experience, which is non-distracted, also means that the mind is united with the body.
Yep.
That is right view. Right view is, again, going over to page 3, right view is knowledge with regard to stress, knowledge with regard to the origination of stress, knowledge with regard to the cessation of stress, knowledge with regard to the Eightfold Path of practice leading to the cessation of stress. This is right view. Stress occurs when the mind is not united with the body. Stress leads us to dependent origination. Distractions lead to fabrications, and that's basically the first link of dependent origination. So how do we avoid this cycle again? I think the way to go about this is to maintain the mind united with the body, and that is by being present every moment, or being conscious of what's going on, our actions, words, deeds, thoughts. Now, that comes from the concentration that we're developing in jhana, because it's very hard to be present in the moment unless we're well concentrated. And that concentration enables us to not be distracted, and therefore leading to stress, and again, another moment of the rebirth of, or another cycle on the wheel of dependent origination. So that's what basically I got out of it.
Beautifully said, Michael. Julia, how are you?
Very good, John. Thank you. I agree with
Rom and Tim and everyone who's saying that this is an extremely comprehensive piece of work. And like Rom said, it's like the cliff notes of the Dhamma. I totally agree with that. And it does seem to go all over, but it seems like the main point is that we understand that everything we experience through our sixth sense base, that these things are all impermanent, and we're impermanent ourselves, living in this, you know, in this world and experiencing things that are impermanent themselves. And this is what gives us stress and suffering, because we try to cling and hold on to these things to make ourselves mortal somehow. But I think that the Buddha closes again with the jhana, because jhana is the main way out. It's the way to free ourselves of stress and suffering. And I think that's why he probably closed it with describing the four states of jhana. That's what I saw from the whole, because it does seem, at first you think, wow, it's going all over. He's describing the five clinging aggregates, and he's got, you know, these conditions of the human conditions of life, and there's some dependent origination, seems like, in there with the birth, you know, birthing each moment. Yeah. So it seems scattered, but it's really not. It's very comprehensive, and he does close it with jhana, with all the four states of jhana, which I think is very important. That's the message there. That's the way out. That's our ticket.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it, Julia. That's our ticket. The subtitle to this is analysis of the Four Noble Truths. So it is. It's a very in-depth analysis of the Four Noble Truths. It's really a more comprehensive teaching on Four Noble Truths and the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. And also, the way that Sariputta gets into jhana leads me to think that the Buddha must have held him in high regard as a jhana meditator, because there's another sutta called the Sariputta Sutta that is all about jhana meditation. And I'm not sure if we get to that in this study or not. I can't remember. But we you know, I teach that two or three times a year, because it is so significant, and his description of it is so helpful, you know. So, thank you. I think Brett, how are you?
Good. Thank you for the teaching. It was really good, and everything everybody is saying tonight is really helpful. And just trying to really understand impermanence, even though that's a huge foundation of everything, but you know, it's I still struggle with that, and with attaching myself to different things and emotions and thoughts and stuff, and I'm getting a better understanding of that, and I think the more I can hear it, and I just need to start applying it more. It's good to see it. It was good to see it in this teaching and hear it and all that stuff. So, but it's good to be here, and thanks for what everybody said, and yourself, John. Thank you.
I'm glad you joined us, Brett. Yeah, I mean, you're just talking about the key themes of the Dhamma, the not self-characteristic and the impermanent world that it lives in. And understanding that is key to the Dhamma. And it's another one of those things, impermanence. I had a student one time that he just started reading the book, and he actually called me. He said, what is this with impermanence? Like, everybody knows what impermanence is. And then he got into it and realized that we don't know what everybody knows the meaning of impermanence, that things change. But what we don't grasp is that we cling to things being permanent, especially things that change. And ultimately, it's my view of myself that I don't want to ever change. That's the thing that is most rigid in our own minds, this view of self. And so when we can start applying impermanence to our own thoughts, we're well on the way to developing understanding. But I'm glad you joined us tonight. Did I get everyone? Because the screen moves around, I can't tell if I got everyone. Did everybody have a chance to talk? Does anyone have anything else to say? So next week, this was the analysis of Four Noble Truths. Next Saturday's talk will be the Madhyamaka Sutta, which is an analysis of the Eightfold Path. And then we're going to get into the some of the lesser known suttas that are kind of the key of this structured study. This is a remarkable teaching. It is rather broad in its application, but it's meant to be that. It's meant to be an analysis of the, really is an analysis of the entire Buddha's Dhamma. It's something that deserves to be referenced over and over again and maybe read, you know, a few times a year. And you know, you can count on me to keep teaching it because it's so key. I will finish with metta, as we always do. Okay, and I'll leave the room open for a little while after we're done, so we can socialize. These are the words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta from the Buddha. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class tonight. Peace. I stopped the recording.
Thank you so much, John. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. Good night.
See you, Lorna.
Good night, all.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support the continued restoration, preservation, and presentation of the Buddha's Dhamma. If you find benefit here, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.